So as Gideon said, my name is Matt Worthington, and I am I'm a grad student at UT, and I have a family. And so let me just show you real quick. This is my family. So first, this is we got Jess and Giselle and me, and I don't know if you can tell, we are Spurs fans, so we're very excited about Kawhi Leonard's 41 points last night, career high. And then the smaller creatures in our family are Champ and Amelia. So they're both learning to get along right now. Welcome. I'm so glad that you guys are here with us on this third Sunday of Epiphany. And I want to do something just slightly atypical, like a disclaimer, right? So And I said it because it feels appropriate for today. So in case you don't know, Vox participates in the broader liturgy of the church. And what that is it's like a guide for the seasons and rhythms of the church globally. So functionally, what that looks like is when somebody gets up here and speaks on Sunday, people aren't just cherry-picking topics, right? They're not just deciding, like, hey, I saw this in the news, I want to talk about this. Okay, what happens is you go to the liturgy, you see what the texts are, and you read those texts, and then you look at the world around you and you reflect on what is the text saying about the world around us. And that's an important question for the people who come up here on Sunday. And it's very challenging to look at the text and say, what is this saying about the world around us, as opposed to, hey, here's what I would like to say about the world around us. And this morning, our text comes from 1 Corinthians, where Paul speaks to a church that is very divided. And his big appeal to them, unsurprisingly, is to be united. And I think this feels very timely for a number of reasons, but primarily given that we exist in a time of great division, where it feels increasingly popular and accessible to us to be divided. And to explain what I mean, I thought it would be helpful to put the ways in which we're divided into some buckets as a way to think about what Paul says before we get into the text. So the first type of division that I think we can all talk about is global division, right? In this bucket, I would put things like politics, religion, race, gender. Obviously, each of these are related, but they have their own unique style or characteristics of division. And under these spaces, there's a whole lot of room for lots of individuals. And because of that, the impact that is felt on account of global division is wide. And it's very great. And just to kind of give some examples here, I think things like the refugee crisis. I think you think of things like the Israeli West Bank wall. I think you think of things like the marches yesterday that are a good example of that. I think images like Ferguson come to mind. Okay, these I think are divisions that are very widely felt by many people. And then the second, I think, would be more local divisions, right? I think those global divisions can get tied into our local divisions, but they're more centered around us, and the impact is not as wide as global division. So how many of you have had like a feud with a coworker? Anybody? Anybody? Okay, I hope your coworker is not here this morning. Anybody have a feud with a family member? How many of you were anxious for any number of reasons to go home for the holidays, or maybe you knew somebody because you were afraid that something would come up and that would sort of turn into like that dinner party episode of The Office. Has anybody seen that? Okay. So I think that, yeah, that's kind of what I mean, is like these local divisions that they're not as widely felt, but we feel them, right? And then the third, and this is a terrible phrase for it, but I couldn't come up with anything better, what I would call technological division. So think of like grocery delivery services, virtual assistants like, sorry, that was like a book that I think would be helpful for people who have local division issues, okay? So it's actually a really excellent book. It's written by a Stanford professor. It's really smart. But the technological divisions would be like grocery delivery services, virtual assistants like Alexa or Google Home. These things can order things for you. You don't have to talk to people. Or things like Amazon Prime. And I point these out because they reduce the opportunities for our society to interact with each other more and more. And for me, this came alive about a month ago. I had ordered a sandwich for delivery while I was studying one night at UT. And the guy shows up, and I go downstairs to the lobby, and I see him sitting there. And I walk up to him, and I'm very hungry, and I've been studying for a long time. And I walk up to him, and I stretch out my hand. And this is not an unusual thing. If you know me, and it probably annoys some people, I just stretch out my hand all the time. That's like the thing I do. So, hey, what's going on? And I stretch out my hand, and I say, thank you so much for bringing me my sandwich. And he just like looked at me, like very, very sort of stunned. And he said, no one has ever shaken my hand and said that. And I kind of froze because I just thought I was picking up my sandwich. And I didn't know what to say. So I just said, well, I'm glad to be the first. And he went, yeah, me too. Thanks. And I think that for me, that really highlighted those types of interactions that are decreasing, where I think the conveniences we're offered, they also create a different sort of chasm that maybe goes unnoticed sometimes. And so no matter what buckets our divisions fall in, they're these huge sources of pain and discontent. They make us feel angry, lonely, resentful, or hateful. They make us feel scared either of ourselves or others. They make our minds and hearts feel clouded or muddy. They can make it difficult to breathe, much less find the space to listen to others that we are divided from. And so this morning, this is where we are. Reflecting on the question of where do we go from here? And as Paul looked at the church, we can look at our country. We can look at our workplace. We can look at our church. We can look at our families, our relationships. How many of you felt drained or hurt or stressed of the events over the past few years or maybe even this past weekend? How many of you, that was not a rhetorical. How many of you, sorry, that was my fault. Yeah. No. And I think that like saying that it was exhausting is a huge understatement. Like, I don't know what appropriate word there is to describe the feelings that people felt over the past couple of years. And this is kind of what our text brushes up against this morning. So in the church of Corinth, lines have been drawn, factions have been formed, and Paul's concern is for a community that is tearing itself apart. So without further ado, let's go into this morning's text, explore Paul's words, and pick the story back up where he leaves off. As is the tradition here at Vox, turn to a neighbor and read the passage out loud as a community before we start unpacking the text. Thank you, because I know that was like a very long read. So let's do a quick overview of what's happening. So Paul is away from Corinth at the time when this is happening, but he's heard about this from somebody named Chloe about how the church is divided. And he says a few quick things. One, don't be divided. Be united. Two, stop going around saying you're this and that because you're not. And three, remember who you are. Remember the good news. Remember the body that you're called to, the church. And sure, it can seem stupid to a lot of people that what we're talking about, But it's not, and you need to remember that. So if I were to ask you if anyone read this and felt like it was prescriptive, did anybody sort of feel like that? No? Okay, yeah. No, we got a few people, and you have more insight than me, and we should talk. So I, because I think when I read this, I sort of was like, this doesn't feel very clear. It's not like, oh, okay, yeah, like I got it. It's like one pill in the morning, two before bed, but not with dairy, right? Like it didn't feel very clear cut. Like if I needed to write an instruction manual, I could do that. But I think that despite this being something that could fill up an index card, I think that if we sort of break it down a little bit, we can find some good news hidden in the text, something hopeful. And I think that we'll find that it takes a willingness on our part to reframe how we see our divisions and what it takes from us to walk the path toward unity. So let's go ahead and sort of dig just a little bit deeper. So let's look at this first verse, verse 10. Can you get that on the screen? So he says, I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree with one another in what you say, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly united in mind and thought. So Paul's telling them not to be divided, but to be united and of the same mind. And I think when I read this, I felt a little uninspired. Like, in theory, that idea sounds very nice, that we should be united perfectly in thought and in our mind. But upon first read, it feels like there's something missing. It doesn't have the same sort of feel that you find in other parts of the Bible where it'll say something like, there should be no poor among you, but there will always be poor among you. Therefore, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted. It's just don't be divided. Be perfectly united in thought and mind. And so what I did is I looked up the word divided in the Greek, and the word that he uses here for divided means to tear in pieces. And so when I thought about this idea of tearing, I heard the text saying, look, you're ripping each other apart. Just come together and find a way to be united. And I don't know that he expected this to happen overnight. I think he just wanted them to commit to finding a way. And perhaps a good way of thinking about it would be like this. So my wife and I have been together for over 8 years. And what that means is we've had a lot of time to figure out how to resolve conflict with each other. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Okay, if you don't, we should take classes from you, okay? How many of you have ever been arguing and then like at some point, and this could be with a spouse or it could be with like, I don't know, a colleague or something, but at some point you're arguing for so long, you go like, what are we even talking about? Has anybody ever had that experience before? Right. So you are not alone. So one day I heard a friend talking about him and his wife, and he said that they ask a few simple questions when they argue. He said if it feels like things are heating up or going nowhere, they just ask each other if either of them feel the following. One, do either of us feel dirty? Like, do we need a shower? Okay. Like, are either of us bothered by the temperature in the room or like outside? Are either of us hungry? Are either of us angry right now? Like, before we came to this conversation, did somebody say something to us that got us angry? Do either of us feel lonely, right? Or do either of us just feel insanely tired? And the acronym that he uses, dot halt, there's an O in there. I can't remember what the O is, but it's not been an issue for us, apparently. And man, I can't tell you how many times when I started to think about my arguments that way, and several of my arguments started out with one of those things. For Jess and I, it didn't necessarily solve any of our arguments, but it gave us a way to find tiny little pieces of understanding. Like, an argument may have continued for weeks or for months, but if we just committed to each other, then each time we could find little pieces of understanding about what the other person was experiencing in that conversation. And through that, we can start to build gaps, or we can start to bridge those gaps between us, and we can start to bridge the gaps that consume our empathy, our compassion, our goodness. Pope Francis, talking about Jesus' encounter with woman at the well, says it this way. Jesus is patient, respectful of the person before him, and gradually reveals himself to her. His example encourages us to seek a serene encounter with others, to understand one another, and to grow in charity and truth. We need to pause to accept and listen to one another. In this way, we already begin to experience unity. Unity grows along the way. It never stands still. Unity happens when we walk together. And that's what I think Paul is asking the church to do here. That's what I think Paul is asking of us, to walk with each other, to grow along the way, to be committed to each other and choose to be here. And along the way, we'll find tiny little pieces of understanding that build each other up. Will new pain be inflicted upon us? Yes. Will old wounds be pressed too hard and ripped open? Almost certainly. And all of them will hurt, but if we're committed to this process, our union with each other can grow more perfect as we walk together. And as much as we'd like to, we don't need to know how all of this works out. We just have to choose to be here, to start walking, to decide we're committed, and along the way, I think we'll find those tiny little pieces of understanding. So let's go ahead and continue with sort of the next part of what Paul talks about in verse 12. He says, what I mean is this. One of you say, I follow Paul. Another, I follow Apollos. Another, I follow Cephas. And still another, I follow Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I did not baptize any of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one can say that you were baptized in my name. And so the second thing that Paul does here is he admonishes the way that the church speaks to each other. He sees their lust for tribalism. He sees how language has become the tool of choice for driving those sharp divisions. And his plea here is an intervention to redirect their language, which means only to separate. On the surface, it's not necessarily bad to have learned from or been most influenced by Paul or Apollos or Cephas or even Jesus himself. We all have people in our lives that are incredibly formative to us, more formative than others. But it becomes problematic when they start attracting themselves and attaching themselves to those people and those things as a way to drive others down. And that's what Paul is speaking to, this uglier part of our humanity. He sees the consequences of the church's language when they cannot, and asks them to have vision for how they speak to each other. Have a vision for language that understands where your true identity is. And it's easy, I think, for us as outsiders to look at this and recognize, like, oh yeah, this is obviously bad, right? Like, we all know you should follow Jesus, not like start signing yourself to different people. But I think we've all been guilty of damaging language. Am I like off on that? Does anybody feel like, okay, cool, I saw a couple hands raised. Cool, thank, I appreciate the honesty. So how many of you have ever read something online that somebody wrote and you went, self, now is the perfect time for you to step away from the keyboard. Okay. How many of you didn't even get that far? Okay. I am in the second part of that question. So William Ury is a writer and a conflict negotiator. He said it this way. The thing is, when we're involved in conflict, it's very easy to lose perspective. It's very easy to react. Human beings were reaction machines. And as the saying goes, when angry, you will make the best speech you will ever regret. Hey, this sound familiar? Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah. So TED Radio Hour had this episode a few weeks ago on reconciliation. That's where I heard about William Ury. But I also learned about a doctor named Suzanne Barakat, who is a family resident at UC San Francisco. She's Muslim and wears a headscarf to work every day, which often prompts slurs from patients who are offended by her. And for a time, she tried always adopting just kind language to other people. But a few years ago, Suzanne's little brother, his wife, and his wife's little sister were all murdered in their North Carolina home by a neighbor that had been harassing them for months because of their faith. And they were about to eat dinner, and he came in and shot all of them. And here, what I'm about to show you, she talks about the struggle that she encountered with language after she returned to work.
Not long after coming back to work, I'm the senior on rounds in the hospital when one of my patients looks over at my colleague, gestures around her face, and says, "San Bernardino," referencing a recent terrorist attack. Here I am, having just lost three family members to Islamophobia, having been a vocal advocate within my program on how to deal with such microaggressions, and yet, silence. I was disheartened, humiliated. Days later, rounding on the same patient, she looks at me and says, "Your people are killing people in Los Angeles." I look around expectantly. Again, silence. I realize that yet again, I have to speak up for myself. I sit on her bed and gently ask her, "Have I ever done anything but treat you with respect and kindness? Have I done anything but give you compassionate care?" She looks down and realizes what she said was wrong, and in front of the entire team, she apologizes and says, "I should know better. I'm Mexican-American. I receive this kind of treatment all the time."
Eugene Peterson said it this way: "We cannot be too careful about the words we use. We start out using them, and they end up using us." And I think this is what Paul is talking about. But it may be hard to hear because it's so counterintuitive to what we hear in the world today. Dismissive labeling, rude interruptions, belligerently shouting past each other, and speaking truth from our gut. These barbs all lead us nowhere noble. They point us towards no kind of peace or reconciliation with each other. They do nothing to bind up the wounds of our broken identities, but instead seek to destroy us from the inside out. And why? Because words have power. They can make us feel like we are in control when in reality we have become powerless to them. And for us today, we must consider what Paul is saying, what Eugene Peterson is saying. We must not become slaves to divisive language, but we must seek to master our tongues and use them for purposes of healing and reconciliation. How many times have we been disregarded, or have we disregarded an opportunity to be more thoughtful about the words we used with a spouse or a family member? How many times have we passed on an opportunity to build up a colleague instead of helping to tear them down? Or maybe somebody on Facebook. This is what Paul is saying. He's saying, this is not who we are. This is not why Jesus died so you could go and burn the building down. But he died to make all things new, from our garbage and piles of junk and the things that hurt us most. We are called to take these and make something beautiful. And our language, Paul says, is the tool we use to accomplish that work. Let's continue. in verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. Not with wisdom and eloquence, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. And so here, lastly, Paul reframes this entire situation and reminds the church in Corinth where their identity is rooted, which is in the gospel and God's power. Now, this language can feel aloof and very fuzzy, I think, to a lot of people, even me. I've read this several times before. And so I think a different way of thinking about this is basically he says, look, I wasn't sent here to do a bunch of ceremonial dunking of people in water. Okay, I came here to tell people that God loves us. He loves me, and he loves you, and he loves that guy over there, and her over there. And he knows all the garbage in all of our lives. And he knows about all the things we do that wound other people or annoy other people. And he still loves us. And that idea seems stupid to a lot of people. But this is why he died, because he loves you. That's it. Don't get it twisted. And that last part really stands out to me. He says, listen, this is not what you're going to hear from a lot of people. It won't make sense to a lot of people. And you may not even like it. You may not even want to listen. But this is a truth. All of us in the church are so broken and have so many little tiny pieces to pick up. And God has asked us to be in the business of loving each other anyway. He's not asking for us to know how to put it all back together. He's not thinking like we do, setting goals and benchmarks and checking in to see how far we've made and our goals and progress with rewards or demerits. So look at what God is doing to us, Paul says, and then do that to other people. To me, this feels like the most practical thing that Paul does, and it's incredibly transformational, but it requires reframing on our part. It requires going up to the balcony and looking at everything below so we can get some perspective. And when I read this, I thought about my dad. I think some of you have heard me talk about my dad. But for those that haven't, he left our family when I was 12 and I didn't see him for 10 years. And since my mother had quit pursuing her education some 26 years before that to take care of our family, his departure meant not only losing like dad, but it also meant entering a life of perpetual poverty. Food banks, housing instability, lack of transportation, visits to mental hospitals, and working after school, these all became a part of my normal, my new routine. And as my life unraveled, I sought answers that would help me make sense of his departure and ultimately help my mother. But the advice I received from very good people, people that I respected and looked up to, in hindsight, was very power-oriented. So things like, makes sense, you're talking to a 12-year-old or a teenager, don't feel the need to call your father. He should call you. Or even if he does call, don't feel like you need to talk to him, okay? Like, it's his responsibility to make things up to you. And so I had that advice. And then on the other hand, I started reading passages from the Bible because I was recently baptized and very enthusiastic about church. I started reading passages where Jesus would contradict that very good advice with things like, if you love only those who love you, why should you get credit for that? You must be compassionate just as your heavenly Father is compassionate. And so I was in this real sticky place. Because on some level, I bought into the rational advice from people I respected or felt loved by. Even if it was a passive belief, I bought into it. But I also committed to my dad because a guy from my church named Mark had shared about the regret he experienced after his estranged father died. So I started considering my father as a human being, and I had never done that as a child. I wondered if he was evil. If not, then how did he evolve into this shadowy, monster-like figure who left our family? Was he like this as a child? Was there a time when he really did love my mother? Had he ever felt lonely or regretful about his choice to leave? Had he ever drank himself to tears, wondering if he'd ever see his kids again? Asking these questions were never easy. I felt very painful and very lonely. They went against my gut idea of my dad and the rational advice I received. They humanized him and spiritualized him. Now, this didn't make things that he did to my mother or to my family right. It didn't fix what was broken. But for me, it served as a starting point. And today, I would still describe things as very far from perfect. But we talk. And he visits our family on occasion. And when he holds my daughter, I see how loved he feels in those moments. I see his humanity and his need for love. Just like I need. Just like my mother needs. Just like my wife needs, like my niece needs, like my daughter will need, and like anyone who has ever walked the planet needs. And here is the place where I can find these little pieces of understanding. I can find what Paul is talking about, stepping back and taking a look at the bigger picture, asking where God is moving and loving and trying to join. And that has been a lifelong learning experience of nearly two decades. And the good news for us is that the gospel invites us to get perspective, to reframe others as spiritual and human beings who are complex and devastating and disappointing and wonderful and terrible and everything in between, and to participate in reconciliation with God and with them. And it doesn't happen overnight, and at many times it may not work. The relationship or friendship may fail. That colleague might insist on wearing you out. And that's okay. Our job is not to resolve. Our job is to be present where we can. To choose to be here when possible. To stay on the path, even if others don't want to walk with us. But when they do, we reframe our perspective of them. And we try to grow along the way. And so this morning, wherever you are, whatever your mood, know that, as the poet Tupac Shakur says, I grew up on Tupac. If you can make it through the night, there's a brighter day. The wounds of division are long and deep. But God invites us to walk. Sometimes in darkness, and make our path by choosing to be here, by speaking words of peace to each other and reframing our perspective. And if we can start this, we can find pieces along the way that add up to something noble and beautiful. I think that's the invitation this morning. And so I'll close with this. A few weeks ago, My niece, my mother, and I, we went to go see a movie called The Monster Calls. Like, upfront, spoiler alert, but also you can look at the trailer and know, like, what's coming. So, I like visual movies like Pan's Labyrinth or Big Fish that weave stories sort of into the fabric of the narrative. And so I thought this would be an excellent movie. With kids, I don't get to go out with a newborn. Like, I don't get to go out and see movies. But I thought this would be a fun movie, and it is. But let me tell you, if you have children, okay, this is not a children's movie. I would not recommend this movie. A lot of parents, and Giselle, you can ask Giselle about it, she was there. A lot of parents were there with their kids, and like the kids were crying, and like the lady next to me was like, honey, are you okay? Like, and she was crying herself, like everyone was crying, we were all crying. So just know it's not a very feel-good movie, and I genuinely think some kids might need counseling after seeing the movie. But, and I'm going to spoil a little bit, so I'm sorry. If you want to, you can cover your ears. But it's about a boy named Connor O'Malley, who is not only wrestling with his dying mother, who has cancer, but he's also being bullied at school. And throughout all this, he has a monster come to him on various nights to tell him stories. And this monster is an ancient yew tree that lives in the churchyard outside his bedroom window. And these stories all seem backward and don't make sense. They don't resolve. And Connor doesn't like them because of that. Because they don't resolve. They don't have the storybook ending that he's familiar with. They're complex and nuanced. And in some ways, Connor hates this. Because from Connor's vantage point, he thinks the tree has come to heal his mother with the medicine from the tree's berries. And there's a sequence near the end when Connor realizes his mother's going to die that day. And he rushes to beat on the tree which has not healed his mother. Why didn't you save her? Why did you let her die? Why didn't you heal like you were supposed to? And the tree, awake from Connor's beatings, snaps back at him and says, "Connor O'Malley, I did not come to heal your mother. I came here to heal you." And I think that's what this all is about. I believe the work of unity is not about trying to foster change in the lives of others, but I propose that it's about learning to be healed ourselves. To look at the sources of pain which drive our divisions and approach our communities with a choice to be here, to speak words of powerful reconciliation and peace, and to reframe how we understand each other. And being willing to walk with each other through this process of being healed and being made more perfect. If we can do that, I think we'll find pieces along the way. Let me pray for us this morning. We give you thanks, O Father, for the life and knowledge which you have made known to us through your Son, Jesus. Yours is the glory forever and ever. As the grain once scattered in the fields and the grapes once dispersed on the hillside are now united on this table in bread and wine, so, Lord, may your whole church soon be united together and gathered together from the ends of the earth into your kingdom. For yours is the glory and power through Jesus Christ forever and ever. Amen.